He's their defense. This is the break in the action. If I were writing the book of Exodus, I would end the book right here. If I were writing, I would say, look at the journey so far, escape. We pillaged those Egyptians. We crossed the Red Sea. We learned the lesson that God is a miracle worker who can make sweet what is bitter. And now we're at a campsite with all the markers of completeness. 12 springs for the 12 tribes of Israel, 70 trees, 70 being the ancient nearest number of completion, and I would put my pencil down. Because this is the place where the desert feels manageable, right? There's water, there's trees, there's enough. I've learned enough. It's nice enough. I'm far enough away from the Egyptians. Never mind that I would quickly overrun those 12 streets. And never mind that I would quickly outstrip any resource that's there. And never mind that I would quickly lose my longing for God. Because I would have tasted the miraculous water, but I would not be reshaped by it. And I wouldn't be depending on Him. I'm not following. The challenge of this section is, will I follow God? Will I follow God enough? Brought to a place that I can manage. I'll be happier than I was before, but not follow the real adventure, which is the Lord Himself. And if I look at this moment through the structure of the book, I can see why this has always been a challenge to me. I got out of Egypt, and so I really want to get Egypt out of me. That is a far more painful process. And so, to truly follow, we have to follow God past what feels like enough. Don't stop merely coming out of Egypt, but following to where He can bring us to Himself. So, a whole camp moves out of Elam and into the desert for 2 months, and there we come to the moment of collective insanity. If we think of Psalm 23 at the beginning as the complete assurance of the Lord's leading, like, I mean, how beautiful this is. The Lord is my shepherd. I have everything I need. He sets me down. He lets me rest in fields of green grass, leads me to quiet pools of fresh water. He gives me new strength. He guides me in right paths as He has promised. If that's complete assurance, then what's happening in our text today is the complete opposite, right? If only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt, where we sat around pots of meat and ate all the food we wanted. But you have brought us out into this desert to starve this entire assembly to death. What? what? So what do you do with people like this? Clap it with me when you got it. For the next 40 years, one owner, two owners rest. One owner, two owners rest. How many people do you think were actually born and died in the wilderness not knowing any rhythm? Before giving the commandment of rest on Sabbath, God will press a pattern of work and rest into their lives. This is not about efficiency and a self-care day. Manna is the beginning of God's promise to bring us to Himself. Because the first thing that God does is to weave back together the first thing that we lost. In the garden, Adam and Eve had all the food and all the water. Joe Fitzpatrick, a New Life missionary and seminary professor, pointed out in the study of Genesis that in the middle of the garden, not off to the side, but inescapably, in the middle of the garden, there is a tree that presses the question, is God good? Do I trust Him? In his book, Praying Like Monks, Living Like Fools, Tyler Seddon writes, in Genesis 3, when the serpent tempts Eve, his strategy is telling. Did God really say you must not eat any tree in the garden? It's interesting to note that at no point does the serpent's temptation become direct. Never does he say, here, try this fruit. Instead, the serpent takes aim at Eve's belief in the character of God. In Genesis 2, God displays His generosity, offering free rein over the garden. Any tree, except this one, is poisonous. The enemy flips that command from broad and generous to narrow and restrictive. Did God really say you can't eat from any tree in the garden? He's flipping the command to make the generous offer seem stingy. He's not asking Eve to eat the fruit. Is chipping at her trust. So God, who has all good options available to Him at all times, chooses this moment to pull back the curse of Genesis 3 to teach trust in utter dependency. Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil, you will eat of it all the days of your life. It will produce thorns and thistles for you, and you will eat the plants of the field by the sweat of your brow. But for this season, instead of thorns and thistles, we will have wafers that taste like coriander and honey. As God moves outside the created order, to teach only two things. Just two things. Remember, this is not a transferable skill, right? Gathering manna in the desert is not going to help them farm better in Canaan. So He's teaching two things. One is to lean on and be nourished by God daily, one boomer. And then one owner. What is the lesson of manna? You cannot stockpile mercy. Whether you gather a little or gather a lot, you have gathered enough. Ever wonder why it's instant stink like instant? If they gathered more than a day's worth? Because it's forcing us into a pattern of trusting who God is. They and we have to act on the faith that God is who He says He is. We have to act on that day, to go out of your tent and gather. And then the next day, We have to trust God in our work, even when, for us, it feels like futility. And then we have a weekly celebration where we delight in the goodness of the Lord. Consider, if the desert is the most important thing in your life, then the day you rest is the day you might die. And the day you stop looking for water is really the day you might die. You would be crazy to rest. But what if we give ourselves to that pattern of obedience and trust? Then rest is the most logical, reasonable outcome of knowing God's character. The insanity is actually worrying if there's going to be manna tomorrow. The most reasonable thing that we can do as God's people is to rejoice. So when we put God's character in the foreground and we trust Him in our work and we trust Him in our rest, and then we get up on Monday morning with Him on the 63rd and we look for the one hour of mercy that God has for us. The other lesson that we learn is that we work and we rest in a community of people bound by that mercy. Ever wonder why it's instant stink, like the stink part? Why not just evaporate? And no one would know. No one could tell if you were trying to hoard it or not. That this is a public and communal life. In Egypt, they were molded into a nation through slavery. And as unifying as that is, it's still going to hit people differently, because in any worldly structural power, there's a hierarchy, even in the slave class. Some get to be managers, some get hauled out to work in the mines. We might have an overseer who's kind or cruel. We might collaborate with their oppressors to report on their neighbors or Roman times. We might become a tax collector. But every power system has some ladder based on who you are or what you can do. And we are all trying to play the game in ways that we gain and don't lose. But please remember about this. Regardless of who you are, or what you have, or what you bring, if you are fed by manna, you are a person rescued from oppression who is fed the same food at the same table exclusively by mercy. No one has any other claim. We gather for a common meal that we cannot provide for ourselves. And what if our lives look like that? So through your day this week, whisper it to yourself. As you gather the mercy the Lord has for you. Throughout their time in the desert, we got water from the rock that defeated the Amalekites, Mount Sinai. The laws and instructions, the golden calf, spies to the promised land, the people turn away. Poor rebellion, the entire Canaanites worshiped the tabernacle, celebrating feasts, poisoning of snakes, leading to the Jordan River. No matter how faithful or faithless they are, the manna keeps coming. God is answering our question, He is faithful. I can trust Him. And so how is that trusting and working? The whole Israelite community set out from the desert of Sin, traveling from place to place as the Lord commanded. They camped at Rephidim, but there was no water for the people to drink. So they quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water to drink." Moses replied, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you put the Lord to the test?" But the people were thirsty for water there, and they grumbled against Moses. They said, "Why did you bring us out of Egypt to make us and our children and our livestock die of thirst?" What is wrong with us? Like, with a mouthful of manna, we accuse God of kidnapping us so that He could take us out to die. Because for all of God's provision, there is only one person who has ever lived a life of trust. In the testing of the wilderness, in a life of homeless ministry, with a very mixed reputation, depending on whether you were a Pharisee or an outcast, to the Garden of Gethsemane and then to the cross, Jesus came not to show us a better way to gather manna, but to become our bread of life. I am your bread and living water. I am your rest. Jesus is our impossible life. There are dozens of passages we could point to, but my heart grabbed onto Jesus' temptation in the desert when the accuser tells him to turn stones into bread, because it perfectly flips the problem that we have. We have bread, but no trust. Jesus had no bread. I completely trusted that kind of God. And ponder this. Jesus' waiting isn't over. God the Son is still waiting for God the Father to bring the fulfillment of his promise. I'm not privy to that conversation, but I don't think it sounds like one. Moses striking the rock in Genesis 17 gives the first faint image of what it will actually take to get Egypt out of our hearts. God instructs Moses, the lawgiver, to take the rod of judgment and strike the rock so that water will flow. Now, this is very odd. I mean, this is a series of non sequiturs that for hundreds of years Jews would puzzle over. Until a Pharisee named Paul of Tarsus would write in 1 Corinthians 10 that the rock is Christ. What does it take? It takes the great exchange. Jesus, who trusted God perfectly, will take the blow of the law so that we, who cannot leave our slavery behind, can have living water. So he shows us that he will bring bread and water to you, and that he will become bread and water for you. And next, as we're getting ready for Christmas holidays, we have that hallmark moment of a family reunion, and Luke shows up. It is the one time in the whole book of Exodus that the people of Israel actually fight. This is also another story that's easy to take off kilter. It's also football season here in Philadelphia. This is not the kind of battle where the Eagles score if I sit in the chair, but they lose if I sit in the sofa. So, you know, like, Moses has to have his hands up, and he's got to be in the jersey or the lucky socks. No. This is not what we're talking about. That's right. The Amalekites pre-exist Abraham in the region. But at this point, they have become synonymous with a famous ancestor of theirs, Jacob's twin brother, Esau. Remember, Esau, who hated his birthright. The blessing was never going to be his, but as the firstborn and his father's favorite, he had every reason to expect it. But the blessing of being a chosen people in a promised land was not worth a bowl of soup to him once he was hungry. The descendants of Esau attack the descendants of Jacob as they are trying to restore the blessing. Blessing that Jacob bribed from his brother and tricked from his father. But Jacob wanted the blessing. And on their way, the Amalekites attack the weak and kill those who are least able to defend themselves. God still orchestrates the victory, but this time it is again not pretty still, but specifically cast to bring God's judgment. With him is Aaron and Hur. Hur is a relative of Moses and Miriam, whose grandson directed the building of the temple. And it's no coincidence that the writer points out that the men connected with the law, the priests, and the temple worship are the ones who are holding out and holding up the judgment of God. As the section plays out, we see that time isn't ordained to heal all wounds. This one is never going to close. Amalekites now represent people who are opposed to God's covenant promise. And in case we might think that these are people defending their homeland against a new group of people who are passing in but might pull a land grab, maybe a newcomer would think that. Somebody new to the region might be saying, oh, yeah, they say they're just passing through, but, you know, I think they're really going to settle here. The Amalekites more than any other tribe. They know where the Israelites are headed. They are marauders who are murdering the weak and the slow. to come and help talk about points here. Please take these passages of God's salvation and put them in your heart and ponder with the Holy Spirit on how the Lord is beginning to lead you into that relationship of trust for Him. Because of what the Lord has done, I'd like to end with an invitation. This is an invitation from Isaiah 55 and from Revelation. So let's read it together. Come, all you who are thirsty, come to the waters. And you who have no money, come buy and eat. Come, buy wine and milk without money and without cost. He said to me, it is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty, I will give water without cost through the stream of the water of life. The Spirit and the bride say, come. Let the one who hears say, come. Let the one who is thirsty come. And let the one who wishes take the free gift of the water of life. Amen.